You're listening to the Ask Drone You podcast. You ask, we answer your drone questions. Whether you're here to turn your passion into profit or you simply fly for fun, we're a community of learners and teachers who aspire to achieve greatness. We are
Drone You.
Hey everyone, welcome to an awesome episode of Ask Drone You. My name is Paul and I have the pleasure of being with Mr. Angad Singh from Pix4D. Welcome to the show, sir.
Yeah, thank you so much, Paul. I really appreciate you having me on and, you know, sitting through my Pix4D user workshop the last 2 days.
No, honestly, yeah. The pleasure is all mine. There are so many nuances to mapping. It is insane. And the amount of knowledge that you have is absolutely mind-boggling. So really, the pleasure is mine.
You know, I appreciate it. I don't know. The more I learn, the more I realize there's so much more that I could possibly know out there.
It's crazy. You know what, though? They say that is one of the keys to success, is that if you have a mind that is open to lifelong learning, chances are your success rate is going to be much higher.
You know, my father used to say the same thing.
You're right. All right. Well, we have you here today because there are so many things with mapping, and I don't think that people truly understand how complex the process is from not only acquisition, but to post-processing, to using Zoom, to then importing your images, to then making the right settings, to then going to step two, making the right settings. I'm so grateful to have you on the show because even I learn every single day when it comes to drone mapping. I mean, it's absolutely insane. And I have to say, when we were talking about our friends in Florida and whatnot, that is a legitimate progression that we've kind of figured out with the whole surveying and drones. It's something that we plan on putting out in the next coming month because we want to prove that you really can get survey grade data.
You absolutely can get survey grade data. I teach surveyors on a weekly basis, you know.
There were, three in our class?
Yeah, more than that, than that. Typically, I mean, I've taught classes that are 40-plus surveyors. I've taught classes to, survey firms directly. I've taught classes to a lot of different folks from different industries. But one commonality is that when we're working with geospatial data, you know, that surveyor is the only one that has the, you know, legitimate ability to put a stamp on their data and say it is of survey grade. I mean, there's a reason that it takes 6-plus years to become a PLS, you know, it is a professional craft, and they understand the way that the Earth works, and they understand the models of the Earth. So it's pretty incredible to work with surveyors, but also to help them integrate this new innovation and this new technology into their workflow. Yeah.
It's definitely a tool, and I'm glad you led up to that, because like all tools, if you don't understand how to properly use the tool is, for lack of a better word, effing useless. Would you say?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, let's think about like really, really good tools out there, like the hammer, right? Mm-hmm. We can think about a hammer is probably one of the coolest tools available because it's pretty intuitive. Even a toddler can pick up a toy hammer and use it to understand that you can hit things and they can go down. So from that perspective, my goal is that you prefaced with saying that mapping technology today with drones is complex. Yes, there's certainly a lot of nuances to understanding how to create, you know, incredibly high resolution geospatial data. But at the end of the day, I think that as technology progresses and as this industry progresses, we need to make it easier and we need to make it more intuitive so that this isn't, you know, the forefront of everyone's thought of how do I create great data, but rather how do we create great data to make truly powerful, you know, actionable insights.
I just have to say, I love how passionate you are about this because it is it is invigorating, it is addictive. And when you finally get into it and realize what you can do with drone mapping, it opens up your mind to almost a whole new world. And I just love how passionate you are.
It's incredibly cool to be able to work with so many folks from different industries. I mean, I've had the pleasure of teaching, you know, police officers and public safety. I've had the pleasure of teaching, you know, land surveyors, remote sensing scientists, researchers, and seeing how we can integrate, you know, this tool of you know, what is multi-ray photogrammetry? What is the modern way of just taking images to create data and seeing how they can use it for, you know, to be honest, incredibly creative applications that you don't always think of.
Which we're doing right now with Marriott with interactive mapping, where we're actually tying in different types of mapping all together in one interactive format. So I agree with you 100%. And I think that the number of uses are astronomical. It's almost difficult to even understand how many things that you can do with drone modeling and mapping. But that brings me to one question. You've been teaching a lot of people. You know, I've been teaching some people, not nearly as many as you've been teaching. I just want to put that out there. But top three professions that are augmenting their businesses with drones right now. Who is it?
I mean, I don't know. I don't know officially.
I know
what,
not statistically. So you have a regression report.
But
you know.
What do I feel and what do I see? Yeah. I think that the top industry is going to be land survey. I mean, the ability to go out and create a topo, create a, you know, a very high resolution topographic map that fulfills legal requirements for survey is truly the most applicable and largest growth that I see and the most of my clients come from. The second's public safety. I mean, let's think about an accident scene. If you have a fatal accident and you have an intersection where you have a couple vehicles that have been involved in that collision, you know, traditionally, the accident reconstructionists who in police departments all around the country are truly brilliant people. You know, I've had the pleasure of working with a lot of police officers and a lot of accident reconstructionists. And these are, you know, intelligent people that see fatalities and see, you know, unfortunate incidents every day. But now instead of taking 2 hours or 3 hours to close a road and take high resolution GPS measurements of that scene and take measurements and put down all the evidence markers, we can take a drone and we can fly it over that scene in 20 minutes and map it to survey grade accuracy. And then we can use that to, you know, it's empathetical evidence in court.
We actually just had a crime scene reconstructionist on the show, two shows before you.
Oh, very cool. Very cool.
And I see your passion and I love it. And I think crime scene reconstruction is so important for mapping. But I've also been warning people because there, and you know this, there are a lot of people out there who go out and they say, I can do drone mapping. I know how to use drone deploy. And you're like, oh, no.
I mean, I don't want to, you know, speak down to a product.
I don't want to say anyone specific. I mean, I'm very, I just mean they go out and use a new app that they think is the coolest thing and voila.
All right. Yeah. You know, I'll get you that. I mean, here's the thing. From my perspective, today, this is a new technology. We need to, you know, really prove it. I mean, when it comes to public safety, the precision of the GPS used to geo-reference that data is what is going to hold up in court to demonstrate, at least, you know, I think this is what I've been told and this is what, you know, majority of people have I've been informed of, is that that GPS that is used to geo-reference the data is what provides the precision to that data. And so by using traditional GPS, RTK GPS is on the ground, you know, total stations, which are not GPSs, but they do provide very, you know, high resolution data. If we use this type of instrumentation to then properly geo-reference, and you know that term ground control point, where we're ground truthing the data, where we're taking the pixels and really plopping them exactly where they need to go on the face of the earth. That's the way that we can show that these data sets are truly to scale and truly representational as historical evidence.
You know, as you say that, it's really interesting because one of the things that I picked up in your class was the fact that sea level is not actually sea level, that there's an actual measurement for the ellipsis around the earth that represents a true ground point essentially to measure from.
Yes, there's, you know, the earth is not round. Well, I mean, it's the not
earth
flat either.
Is flat.
It's certainly not flat, okay? I mean, you know, as a geospatial scientist, the earth is not flat.
I think if you said that on the show, that would be bad.
Well, but the earth is not round. The earth is not flat. The earth is almost like a piece of paper that's been crumpled up and it has bumps and it has dips and it looks like that. And there are tremendous ways that mathematicians throughout history have created what are called datums or projections where, I mean, they're two different concepts, but it's the idea that how do we represent that three-dimensional earth on a 2D surface or, you know, and how do we create the lines that truly provide us with how that graph has been created? I mean, one of the most popular, I mean, this is getting, you know, we can talk about projections for days. let's reel it back in.
Okay, all right, let's reel it back in. So the reason I brought you on the show is that, again, you've taught me so much in the last couple of days, and I thought I knew the nuances to mapping. After working for Major League Baseball and competing with a bunch of people and getting the contract, I was like, I'm the king of mapping. I'm not. And I learned so much, like, just so much. And I wanted to bring you on the show to say, let me bring it back. But before I tell them why I wanted to bring you on the show, recently we had someone come to one of our mapping classes.
Yeah.
And we're more practical, like acquisition, we're like workflow, not just the processing. We don't go nearly as deep as you guys.
Yeah.
It's and I think that there are benefits and negatives to both. And
yeah.
That's not important.
No, absolutely. Yeah.
The important part is we had someone who went to another drone school.
Mm-hmm.
And then they came to ours and they said, you know, I have to give it to you. I didn't truly understand how powerful the software is.
Mm-hmm.
And the other drone school taught me how to use an application and that was it.
Yeah.
They had one drone, that was it. But with your class, you showed me the practical application. We could fly our own drones. We had a hands-on thing. And I realized how powerful the software is. And to the person, Alice, who said that, you can go 10 times deeper into the software. And that's why I believe that you're here, because you are so smart and intelligent when it comes to photogrammetry. It's stunning. It's absolutely stunning. And that that being said, I'm blowing your head up right now. I know. And it's you deserve it. But anyway, I wanted to talk about some of the nuances that really grabbed my attention, because we've been doing comparisons between drones and noticing some differences. And there are some things that I learned from you that I think could provide a significant amount of value to other people out there. And I know Rob may hate me for this, but I think that there is a lot of value in going to your class. Even if you go to our class and learn the workflow on a practical standpoint, you should still go to their class because it's so deep. And in all honesty, I think that a practical aspect would be so powerful because
yeah.
I think did you notice how many people didn't come the second day? Or was it because they didn't pay?
No, they didn't pay. So we do a 2-day class. The first day is, I mean, you pay for my class. Everybody comes to my class.
Yeah.
But no, it's a 2-day class where the first day focuses on everything where if the camera was straight down at what's called a natter angle, when we're taking the camera and we're looking directly at the ground. And then on the second day, we focus a lot more on terrestrial data capture as well as oblique imagery, where we can really increase the resolution of the 3D models. I mean, so I think that that's the thing. I mean, the last couple classes we've taught in the US have been sold out completely. I think that, you know, working for a company like Pix4D, where it's tremendous, I mean, obviously to work for the company, but what's really important is that I want people to learn the technology and I want them to learn how the science works so that when they create that data set, they're confident. And when they don't know what's going wrong, they're confident about knowing where to get help and also what to do and what makes logical, intuitive sense.
Yeah.
So from that perspective, yes, our class has been designed. The Pix4D user workshop, the Pix4D private training, these are curriculums that, I mean, I take it very personally that I teach to a very high level and I want my subject matter to be, you know, the correct information. I, you know, if I don't know something, I say I don't know something. And I want people to know. So
I was actually fascinated when today you were like, you asked me a question. I didn't know the answer. I'm like, what?
You can't know everything, man. Come on. No, I'm not the mapping master. You can't know everything.
Okay. All right. Well, let's get into some details here. Yeah, so
let's talk tech.
I love getting nerdy.
Me too. A lot of hours in the library and school.
If there's
eh?
Something that gets me going, it's getting nerdy.
All right, let's do it.
You ready to get nerdy?
Yeah, let's actually get nerdy.
Okay, all right. Well, so one thing we're having way too much fun right now. One thing I found really interesting is that the focal length from the sensor to the lens can play a huge role in not only the accuracy of your maps, but what you collect in your ground sampling distance. So before we get into the how you treat your drone also affects your mapping, can you help us understand why focal length matters and why you could see different image sets from different vehicles, even if you fly at the same altitude?
So let's talk about camera specifications. So traditional photogrammetry, we do something where we take a camera and we put it into a highly controlled laboratory setting, and we understand how that camera's behaving. They're called camera distortions. These are the parameters that are used to understand how that camera is actually taking in this information.
And this is like a calibration, right?
It is. It's in regards to the calibration, most certainly. So focal length, which, I mean, there's a proper, you know, technical answer, but let's think about it simply. It's kind of what the distance from the sensor to the lens is. I mean, if you take a DSLR camera, you know how you can twist it and the lens will get longer? Effectively, what you're doing is increasing the focal length of that sensor. With photogrammetry, it's incredibly important that the entire image set is treated with one focal length, and that is the stock, or we call it focusing to infinity. So for example, if you're capturing data with your cell phone, 3D modeling a vehicle, a lot of times for public safety, we'll have accident reconstructionists take a DSLR camera or a cell phone and take images of a vehicle so that they can do a great crush profile around that vehicle. And I never want them to zoom in and out, because part of the calibration in the software to ensure that you're getting a geometrically accurate model is to understand what that stock focal length of that sensor is and to utilize that information to then calibrate it. So you said something called ground sampling distance. This is the most important metric or unit of analysis that we need to take into account. The ground sampling distance is your pixel size. It's your spatial resolution. It's essentially saying that if you have a 1 centimeter pixel size, then that pixel in the data product corresponds to 1 centimeter, 1 square centimeter in the real world. So this is something that's really important. We need to understand what our ground sampling distance is, because that directly impacts the accuracy of your data set. So if I'm planning a mission, I first think, what's my accuracy? If I'm a surveyor, typically surveyors want to achieve about roughly a tenth of a foot.
So less than 100 feet. Would you say 90 feet, 100 feet? If I'm flying, say I'm flying Phantom 4
Pro. Okay, you're talking about what, now you're getting into the hardware specifics, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm
saying, I want to get nerdy because I want you to cut me up right now.
The nerdiest answer is hardware agnostic, because it doesn't matter what drone you're flying and what sensor you got on your drone, okay? I'm a data guy. I care about the camera. So let's think about that sensor. We need to understand what the resolution of the sensor is, and we need to understand what the focal length of our sensor is, and we can use these two variables in conjunction with how high you're flying to figure out what your pixel size or the resolution of your data product is. I mean, think about it like this. If I'm looking at you, I'm over here, I see you in pretty good detail. But if I get real up close and personal, I got closer to you, I got closer to the object I'm looking at, I see you in finer resolution or finer detail. It's the same thing with a drone. It's the same thing with a camera. You want higher resolution, fly closer to the ground. I mean, let's talk about, okay, if we
this
do...
This sounds like real brain surgery here.
I don't want it to sound like brain surgery. I want it to sound intuitive, you know?
It is,
I mean,
intuitive.
You want to see something, you want to see something in higher detail, get closer to it. That's it.
I
love
it.
So with a drone, you want to achieve a higher resolution, get closer to the ground. I mean, let's talk about, okay, if I did have to talk about a specific hardware, DJI Phantom 4 Pro, 20 megapixel sensor. It also has what's called a global sensor. And we can talk about this if you want.
Let's talk about it.
All right. We'll talk about it in a minute. But that global sensor.
Teach me how to Dougie.
That global sensor on that DJI Phantom 4 Pro, which is 20 megapixels, based off the stock focal length of that camera, which is 8.8 millimeters, in conjunction with the resolution of the sensor, which is 20 megapixels, if we fly roughly 90 to 110 feet, you can achieve about a 1 centimeter pixel size if you process the data properly in Pix4D.
And that's a huge caveat. I just want to interrupt you for a second because I don't think people really understand how big of a caveat that is. There are literally 30 things that you need to understand, well, if not more. No, there are templates.
Today, yes, there are templates
to help you out, but you've got to understand what you're doing.
Absolutely. But my goal is to demystify all the complexities in relation to the science. I want it to be intuitive. I want it to be easy to do. And the goal of teaching people is to have them have a comprehensive understanding, but have it seem logical and have them just be able to take this information and apply it practically in their workflow.
No, I love it. I love the passion. Really, we should do more shows together.
I'm game, man. Let's go.
Got a golf clap over here. Got a nod over here. We're doing fantastic. Okay. So focal length, you just talked about accident reconstruction. You don't want people taking pictures at different zoom. So zoom has a really very real effect.
Don't zoom. Focus your camera. It's called to infinity. Basically, don't zoom in at all. Just leave it. Take a bunch of photos. If you want a higher ground sampling distance, physically take your body closer to the object if you're using a cell phone or a DSLR. And if you're using a drone, lower that altitude.
I love it. Okay, so... let me ask you, I mean, I'm just going to go super deep for a second. Is it true that if, let's say, I fly a Nader mission,
yep,
at 90 feet. I'm getting that 1 centimeter or 1/10 of a foot. Okay. 1/10 of a foot. And then I fly a crosshatch 70 degrees and then I fly orbits. Is it true that if I process those separately with different template settings and then merge those projects later, am I going to get more accurate data?
Well, let's think about why we're doing this, right? In my perspective, the reason that you would fly an orbit and a, you know, a double grid or an oblique mission and a natter or a straight down grid mission is if you want to have the most beautiful, dense, visually appealing 3D model.
Well, this is Drone U.
Well, if you're interested in that, absolutely. If you're a surveyor and you just need a good topo, I don't think you need to do that.
Yeah,
but if you want to create, you know, the most tremendously beautiful three-dimensional model that you could then go put into a VR environment, you know, then sure. The more images, let's break it down. Photogrammetry can only reconstruct what it can see from the image content. If you do not have, I'll repeat that again. Photogrammetry can only reconstruct what you can see or interpret from the image content. If you do not have image content of a particular surface, such as the facade of a building or, you know, underneath a roofline, if you don't have image content of that surface, how is photogrammetry, how is Pix4D, or, you know, truly any other software out there going to be able to take this information and deliver you that beautiful 3D model? So sure, if you want a great 3D model of a house, fly a drone over top, take out a DSLR camera or even a drone and fly in orbit at a lower altitude where you're focusing completely on the object that we're looking at. And in this way, we're getting more image content of what we want to look at. We're getting image content of all of the surfaces. And through this, we can achieve a beautiful 3D model.
That's awesome. So you bring up another question or two questions. Literally, when I was in the Intel talk today and talking to Anhiel, I was like, I literally wish you were with me there because I was like, question. I think they have a fantastic product. But so you talk about, all these nuances. How important is weather?
Weather? I mean,
if I'm flying on an overcast
day. In terms of
day,
what? Okay, let's talk about a couple things. With weather,
let's
talk about wind, right? So wind, people say, hey, it's really windy. I can't fly my drone. All right, don't fly your drone on a windy day. If you're not flying that drone, you're not capturing data. So it doesn't matter.
But so if windy you are, day doesn't matter.
Well,
if your
here's where
speed
it does
script.
Matter. Here's where it does matter. If it's a very windy day, the quality of the inputs are going to degrade before it is safe to fly. What that means is, the wind is going to move the objects on the ground. You're going to have dense vegetation, such as trees and leaves moving around. You're going to introduce a dynamic nature to what was previously a static scene. Essentially, what that means is stuff's moving around. Think about how photogrammetry works. We want to match points or unique points from static objects in multiple images. So basically, if I see one point on the ground from 10 different images, that's 10 different angles I can use to triangulate where that point exists. But now, if it's quite a windy day and things are moving around, dense vegetation is moving around, you're going to maybe introduce the scenario where those objects are moving around to such a degree where now we can't match static points. But that is to say, that is the fundamental theory behind that concept. But at the end of the day, everybody's mapping in all environmental conditions and having great success with it. So as long as you understand and you truly divulge into that information to understand the quality of your point cloud, the quality of your inputs, there is no reason that the majority of scenarios cannot be successfully mapped.
Wow. Wow. I was just going to say, so if I'm listening to this, I'm hearing I need everything to be perfect to be mapped, but you just kind of said the opposite.
No, I mean, absolutely. From the theory, an agricultural field is pretty hard to map. Yet, that's one of the most powerful use cases.
Okay, so hold on. It's really, you just brought something up that's really important because the way that you map ag, whether it's multispectral RGB or fake NDVI or real NDVI.
Please don't use fake NDVI.
You want to talk about that for a second?
Yeah, absolutely. Because, okay, let's talk about
can we
this.
Talk
I'm
about,
passionate about this
Can we
one.
Talk about why a Phantom 4 Pro utilizing any application out there, is not truly accurate to NDVI?
So NDVI, firstly, it's called a vegetable index. Essentially what that means is, all right, let's break it down.
Healthy tomatoes.
Let's break it down to the very fundamental concept of remote sensing, because this is a pain point that I experience all the time, and I'm a remote sensing guy. We see a plant as green because all wavelengths of light are being absorbed by that plant, and some wavelengths of light that we as humans see as green are being reflected. It's the same thing. That's how colors work, right? So if what we want to do is we want to be able to differentiate in a sensor exactly what wavelength of green light is being reflected from a plant. If we can differentiate, if we can say that this one plant is, you know, having a wavelength of light, let's say, you know, 672 nanometers, that's getting way too technical. I'm not going to go into that. if they are nanometers is the unit used to understand these. They're called spectral signatures, but we can always, that's a completely other, that gets very technical. Basically, the idea is that a camera needs to understand this light. If a camera is not built to pick up those specific wavelengths of light, you do not have empirically correct data. You cannot make empirical evidence, you know, you cannot make actionable insights on data where the sensor was not properly calibrated nor built for that particular use case. So that's why there are products like the Parrot Sequoia or the MicaSense Red Edge. These are just two examples of sensors that are purpose-built for that use case, where they're designed to pick up wavelengths of light in that particular spectrum. And so then also there's a proper workflow to follow where you're calibrating that sensor, because on different days with different, you know, the sun is at a different angle in the sky, it will impact the data in a different manner. Essentially, this is a term called radiometric calibration. Radiometric calibration. Incredibly important. If you want to make empirical value judgments on a field, on a farm field or on a plant, you need to ensure that that data has been radiometrically calibrated.
The police hear that you are giving too much information away to farmers to make them richer, so they're coming. They can't hear it, though.
If we can use technology like this to help a farmer increase his yield, that's brilliant.
It is.
I mean, food security, food scarcity, these are serious problems that the world faces. And if we can take this technology and start to utilize it in a way where we can help farmers better manage their resources, that's fantastic. But you cannot do that if you don't understand the science. You know, obviously I'm quite technical, but you need to at least know that you're doing the right workflow so that you're not giving wrong information. Because you cannot go to a farmer with a map that was not radiometrically calibrated or collected with a proper sensor and tell them something, and then they go and apply some, you know, chemicals, or they do some sort of variable rate treatment to that field, and you can potentially impact their livelihood. I mean, a farmer has...
I think you have a huge impact.
You have a huge
impact. Because people
are
saying,
well,
we're going to be at 7 billion people here soon. How are we going to feed all those people? The answer is right there. And not only that, they're making more money, which farmers have been kind of put to the wayside for a really long time, and commodity prices have been killing them. So let's be real.
I mean, everybody eats. Farmers are the backbone of our society, and you have to respect them. A guy gets 30 years or 30 to 35 seasons to make that perfect yield, to make that perfect crop. And I never wish for any drone, you know, pilot or data processor or scientist to be the one responsible for, you know, messing up some guy's field, because that's not cool.
But what the one thing that I think the Pix4D has done really, really well is the fact that not only can you take that data with Pix4D Capture, interpret that data with Pix4D, but now with Pix4D Ag, we can export that data into a format that can be utilized by like Caterpillar vehicles that are autonomous in nature,
yep,
and can go out and say, I know the problem, I'm going to go out and I'm going to solve the problem.
Yeah, this is a variable rate, right? I mean, basically, can we go into a field and can we say, okay, this particular section of the field needs this, you know, application of chemical, and how can we make it so that they're not applying too many chemicals? Because nobody wants a lot of chemicals in their food, but we want enough where, I mean, the crop's at least growing, so...
Yeah, I think you should watch that documentary, What's With Wheat? Seriously, it's worth it.
I think there's so many things we have to learn, right?
Yeah, no, that is so true. That is so true.
Yeah.
Well, I think we've gone over a significant amount of information.
Yeah, I hope we didn't go through too much information too quickly. I don't want to, you know, burst anyone's brains here.
I think I'm going to just kind of end it here because I actually want to have you come on again because there are so many nuances. I mean, we could have a whole show on if we were to go into processing nuances. Okay, let me give you one example. I just learned I had two cameras flying at the same distance from the ground, AGL, and I had two significantly different ground sampling distances. I'm sitting there like racking my brain.
They weren't significantly different.
0.47 to 0.77 centimeters.
All right, I got to look at that quality report. But yeah, it's possible. It's possible.
But anyway, flying two different vehicles, right? And when I changed one particular setting in my PIX4D settings, the ground sampling distance changed to 0.71 from 0.77.
I know what option you're talking about. This one's important. You want to give them one quick fact? Should we say one more quick fact?
Let's say one more quick fact.
All right.
And I mean, you're just going to burst the bubble here? You're going for it?
I'm going to burst. Actually, no. We'll leave it for the next podcast.
No. I want to go into it. So what you have to understand is that different drones and different cameras have different styles of shutters. And in fact, today, when you were like, yeah, the X7 camera has a rolling shutter, I was like, there's no way I just spent $9,000 on a camera and it's got a rolling shutter.
You mean the X5?
No, the X7.
Does the X7 have... I don't know if the X7 has a linear or global.
It's a linear shutter and it's electronic. So it's not...
I didn't know that.
It's not a global shutter. And that's why it's not good at mapping because I tried mapping in windy conditions and super fast shutter speed. It still didn't work.
I mean, this is a really big point of misinformation in the industry and it's called linear rolling shutter versus global shutter.
Let's give them two examples of drones so maybe they understand that like even though they think it's the same camera, it's not.
Okay, so...
And if you want, I'll give the example. Because I don't want you to get in trouble. Because I have no problem.
I can't get in trouble. You know, I mean, yeah, go for it. Go for it. All right, go for it.
I'm going to save you here. And this battery is about to die because of the light. So we're going to have to end this soon. Phantom 4 Pro, unique H520. One of them has a global shutter. One of them has a linear shutter.
Yeah.
Which one?
Well, the only one that I'm concrete on is that a DJI Phantom 4 Pro has a global shutter. So actually, it's not important what hardware is it's not important about what the unique's a fantastic device. Obviously, DJI makes fantastic devices. These are great hardware out there. But what's truly important is to understand the shutter model. And that is that in a linear rolling shutter, rows of pixels in the sensor are triggered at different times to collect that data. In a global shutter, you can think about the sensor opens, the image is captured, and then the sensor closes. What that does is, if you have a linear rolling shutter and your drone is moving when you're taking photos, you could potentially be moving 3 or 4 or 5 feet before the camera stops taking a photo. And that can cause geometric distortions in your image content. It can cause an additional error to appear. So that's why in PIX4D there is a there's an algorithm, the linear rolling shutter correction algorithm, and I would totally go on the blog and look at it. Linear rolling shutter correction. How do you fix for that? I mean, in some ways,
it
makes a huge difference, huge difference. And if you have a linear rolling shutter camera, just fly a little bit slower.
Yeah, I think that's good. On that bombshell, guys, that is going to do it for us today, as we only have 2 minutes left on the card. How do I say thank you? Like, thank you.
Give me a high five.
High five. Love it. All right. If we want to find out more about you, where can we find out more about you?
You can hit up training at PIX4D. You can hit me up on LinkedIn.
Awesome.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm around. I'm at drone shows. I'm teaching all over the country.
I'm at drone shows.
Yeah. You know, people, I was in the airport the other day. I was flying, taking a connection, actually here through Denver, and two different people shouted out to me. The first one was like, "Hey, PIX4D instructor." And I was like, that's wild.
That's awesome. All right, guys. Well, if you want to find out more about him, check it out. Go to PIX4D.com. But that is going to do it for us today. If you found this information valuable, if you found it useful, if you just loved his hair, leave us a review on iTunes. Really appreciate it. We've hit the 200 mark. Thank you so much. But really, those reviews help other people find the show and also find this valuable information. which is important for the progression of the industry as a whole. But that's going to do it for us today. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
You're very welcome. Yeah. Thank you. My name is Paul, and you're listening to another awesome episode of Ask Droneu.
We believe that videos, images, words, and sounds have the absolute power to inform, inspire, and entertain. We reject indecision, confusion, and vanity, for they work against the community. We are united under the virtues of safety and knowledge. We are a training community of learners and teachers who encourage and energize each other to achieve greatness. We are pilots, videographers, photographers, freelancers, business owners, enthusiasts, experts, and apprentices. We are creators. We are the Droneu.